effective emergency management and endangers the public. According to internal emails seen by CNN, FEMA has ordered the employees to sign non-disclosure agreements and schedule interviews with investigators as part of the probe. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Welcome to Africa Now! Today's show features foreign involvement in Sudan's war dissected. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Muzam Muntali. The music in the background is Al Amal by Nori and his Dopa Band. Since war broke out on April 15, 2023 in Sudan between the Sudanese Armed Forces, SAF or SAF, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, led by General Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, also known as Hemeti, over 13 million people have been displaced internally and externally as refugees abroad. Tens of thousands have been killed, and over 20 million people, about half the population, face acute food insecurity. The show features a recent conversation dissecting foreign involvement in the war in Sudan with Musa Baba of Ayan Network, a media outlet in Sudan. The conversation dissects and contextualizes the conflict, focusing particularly on external players exacerbating the war and regional dynamics and the exploitation of Sudan's resources. Here is the conversation. Musa Baba, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Moisa. I really appreciate it. And thank you for your coverage on Sudan. Well, as you probably know, it's much needed.
Yes, very much needed. And also, thank you for all the work you do and educating all of us on what is happening. I wanted to unpack some of the things that we sort of glanced over in our last conversation. I mean, we've talked about it, but this time I wanted to really focus on the foreign involvement in Sudan's war, dissecting it in completely, so people have a much better understanding of what is happening and some of the players who have been involved in this war, as well, and also historical issues that have led to some of the issues that are taking place today. But I mean, as we wanted to remind folks, we're talking about the war in Sudan, which is between the former allies, which was the Sudan Armed Forces led by Burhan, and also the Rapid Support Forces led by Hemeti. The main thing we wanted to do today is looking at the external players, how they are connected to these folks and who are involved. First of all, Musab, can you just help us by listing the countries and or actors involved?
Okay. So it's mainly there are two major backers of the war, and then there's, secondary backers of it, or backing with, certain expectations in the future. But generally, if you look at the main backers, the RSF, of course, is backed by the UAE. And that's kind of a well-established fact that's been reported on a lot. It's been researched a lot. And SAF's main backer is Egypt, with Egypt kind of playing more of a kind of a long-term role within the support of SAF and with the support of military rule in Sudan all overall. You know, the UAE has been kind of a silent, a monetary supporter of the entire government since 2019. But Egypt has been squarely supporting the military even before, like right after the removal of Bashir. And they got a very strong foothold in Sudan. But even Egyptian intelligence has always been involved in Sudanese affairs. So these are the two main backers. The RSF doesn't have, outside of the UAE, it doesn't have a lot of backing except from the general kind of arms market where, you know, they can kind of buy their own weapons from the general market. But SAF has other sideline supporters, like, for example, Turkey. You know, the Turks really want to kind of establish themselves as major SAF supporters, selling weapons. You know, just seeing them, like, you know, resume their flights to Sudan recently. A lot of the former Bashir National Congress Party are in Turkey, of course, because they support a lot of the kind of, you know, more theocratic parties in Sudan, especially like, you know, the NCP, which is an offshoot kind of like, you know, Muslim Brotherhood type of entity. So they always support those countries. There are countries that have more passive support to SAF, like Qatar, for example, and Saudi Arabia, working more on, like, you know, helping out on the humanitarian front and everything, but not taking an active role in supporting the war head on. For those, the main two are the UAE on the RSF side and Egypt on the SAF side.
Yeah, well, it also impacts the, as you mentioned, Egypt has a long connection with Sudan, right from even when the colonial rule. You have Egypt there. So I think if you could just help us unpack that situation, because it doesn't just happen when Bashir comes to play in 1989 when he came in the coup, but help us understand that, well, as you said, that they have a strong foothold in the country.
Absolutely. So that's the complication, exactly as you stated, with Egypt, is that it's a remnants of a colonial order. After the Turco-Egyptian, you know, Egypt kind of helped colonize Sudan in two periods. You know, the first was during the Ottoman rule, you know, with the Turco-Egyptian condominium ruling over Sudan, and then after that the Anglo-Egyptian rule, then that started, you know, late 19th century, going up until like the independence of Sudan in 1956. Throughout these periods, Egyptian military and civil service and everything have been used along with the colonizing forces to basically control Sudan, because there is kind of a cultural familiarity, especially in the northern parts of Sudan in the center. So when it came to independence, you know, before that, there is still a lot of, you know, suspicions that that military connection, that security pact between the two armies has never been completely, you know, disentangled or dismantled, you know. And this kind of goes into, then we get into the sensitivity of Sudan and where it is strategically. You know, where between Sudan and Israel, there's only one country, and that's Egypt. You know, people tend to forget that Sudan is extremely too close to that region for the U.S. and Israel to kind of let it do its own thing. So a battle for Sudan's sovereignty has always been kind of, you know, in the background, lurking in there. And even, you know, when the Abraham Accords and everything, was recent as 2020, there was this unbelievable insistence that Sudan is added to the countries that normalize with Israel. You know, in a way, also the war that we're seeing right now is kind of like not a direct consequence, but it is following the pattern of, okay, if you don't, if you're refusing the normalization with Israel, then, you're going to be ruled by RSF and SAF. And that's basically one of the reasons why the civilian government of Hamdok was overthrown, because of their refusal to fully normalize with Israel. So even Egypt, when it has its stranglehold on SAF, politically, intelligence-wise and everything, they're doing it under a bigger umbrella or a green light from Washington and Tel Aviv to look at Sudan as kind of, the backyard of that region. If you look at the Abraham Accords and then you look at Netanyahu putting up the map of the new Middle East and, like, the countries that are blessed and then the countries that are cursed, Sudan is always there within those countries, along with Egypt. So it's almost like the relationship with Egypt isn't just within the context of a relationship between two countries, Sudan and Egypt. It really is part of this bigger kind of Israel-centric, rule or regime in the region, in the Middle East region. And of course that, pretty much kind of detaches Sudan from the African context and puts it as, like, in the back burner of the Middle East.
Again, that's Mossab Baba. He is with AN Network, which is a media outlet in Sudan, and we're dissecting the foreign involvement in Sudan's war. I wanted to also to expand the conversation about Egypt's role, because it's, I'm glad you kind of put in that in this geopolitics of what's happening today, and it's always been this thing in the background, because even when we go to 2011, when Hosni Mubarak was taken out by the popular movement, the revolution that took place, the uprising that took place in Egypt at that time, and then a similar situation as what happened in Sudan, where you had the civilians coming in to, this was the what was called the Arab Spring. Coming in and then taking over. But then soon after that, of course, as we see, the military came back in Egypt's,
Yes.
yes, and that and asserted its stranglehold. And of course, Egypt is the second biggest military recipient after Israel from the United States. So you don't, one shouldn't, wouldn't be surprised if the US was also uneasy about the changes happening democratically in Egypt. And then we look at the Sudan as well, and 20 you have the uprising in Sudan against the military in 2019, a few years later, and then the same situation happens where the military hijacks it as well in 2021. So
Yes.
do you when they're looking at that, was there, do you see also overtly and covertly connections in that trans the up the hijacking of the movement towards a more representative government in Sudan by its neighboring country military, Egypt,
Yes.
under Assisi?
Yeah. So that's where also the connection, if you look at all of the countries that are normalizing with Israel, there's a very strong direction to keep those countries in authoritarian rule. And not to exclusively put it on that, but if you take Egypt in 2012, for example, this is the first election that they've ever had in history, and for the Mohamed Morsi, once he won the election, this is also where kind of the split between the lip service of the international community and then what their security state actually wants. The people clearly voted for Mohamed Morsi and won an election fair and square. But, actors like the UAE and Israel and these guys pushed for, like, they can't have a Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt, in Cairo, especially one that wasn't playing ball. Even though they're a lot more sophisticated than, people give credit to. And by playing a big mediator role in the Israel fact and, the Israel-Palestine conflict and stuff like that. But still, the insistence was that, a population of 120 million people, bordering Israel and, like, just across the pond from Europe and, in such a sensitive area, it seems like there was just no room for a democracy over there. What if the people started, taking a very hostile stance, especially in the Sinai region and those places that are bordering with Israel? So there is a kind of bigger strategic thing of not allowing the civilians to rule, whether it's Egypt or whether it's Sudan. Like, there's it's almost like this is a prescription that's been given to the region. So with Sudan, we've seen the same thing. We've seen kind of the transitional government come in, and they were very lenient with the West in general. Like, there were some ridiculous demands during the Trump's first presidency, where now this transitional government, led by people who've overthrown the Bashir regime, are being pressured to pay fines for terrorist attacks that have happened during the Bashir regime. For example, the bombing of the USS Cole in the year 2000, the bombing of the Tanzania and Kenya embassies in 98. The Sudan was asked or demanded was demanded to pay like $300 million for each one of these incidences, or for them all together. I'm not sure about the exact number, but at a time where the country is completely broke and, like, there's, problems with, like, providing bread and electricity and, like, some very basic needs. So that was kind of a sign that there, and of course, it was pretty odd that that would be a demand of a civilian government that just came in. And on top of that, then came the issue of the normalizing with Israel. Both SAF and RSF were kind of in a race to go and do the normalization, while the civilian government led by Hamdok refused, and they said this is a matter for an elected parliament in Sudan that would come in and then make that decision. It's not their place as a transitional government to do the normalization. And a little bit after that, they got overthrown, and Burhan and Hammadi came into power, and they fully took control of the whole country. A year later, they went to war. So, as we always diagnose Sudan's primary issue as being an internal issue of fragmentation and, like, internal repression, and that's true. But it's impossible to paint the picture of what's going on in Sudan without looking at these geopolitics and where Sudan is being controlled from, as far as the influence and the funding and everything that goes into, supporting and putting in place military factions to rule the country.
Before we get into the other players, I wanted to also bring up the economic connection between Egypt and Sudan on the military side, because the military in Egypt acts like a corporation, multinational corporation, in within the country, owning things, and a similar situation, I guess, would have happened in Sudan, right? Is a correction? Oh, is that correct?
That's correct. In Sudan, it's a little, it's not as big and organized as the military economy in Egypt. In Egypt, the military controls everything, between the military industrial complex to, monopolizing different economic sectors like construction and mining and energy and everything that you can point to that would bring in income is controlled by the military. In Sudan, it was different, but that's where the push was going towards. Sudan had some civilian, industrialists that have had a huge, role in developing Sudan's economy. And, granted, it was in a neoliberal way, and, it was very heavy on privatization and, following the World Bank prescriptions and stuff like that. But it was not 100% controlled by the military. A lot of people say that the one of the points of the war right now is to have the military reclaim all of these economic sectors and work in them. We know that one of the main sectors that both SAF and RSF are heavily into and has heavily supported their operations is the gold industry. It's the gold has become the number one export of Sudan after South Sudan gains its independence in 2011. And that's been the main, driver of also, funding the militaries and, creating entire economic realities, a new reality that moves away from agriculture, moves away from industry, and moves towards more an extractive industry. And that's kind of what's happening right now, and it's being, expanded as far as the military's control on these resources. Even things like gum arabic, the RSF reportedly controls about 60% of the gum arabic production, and of course, it's smuggled by them and sold, in the market after that because of how lucrative it is. And that's one of the main things is during from 2019 after Bashir is gone, like the idea of security sector reform and not having multiple armies in the country and getting the army out of the productive economy. That was one of the biggest things that were on the ads, but that can get kicked down the road, and that's one of the kind of the reasons why there was overthrow of military coup against the civilians, and then ultimately the war itself. Like each side does not want to give up on these empires that they've built inside of Sudan, feeding the military directly, but also having a huge business network from the mining process to transportation, controlling the trade routes, all of that stuff is kind of some of the packages that come along with cementing their military rule on Sudan.
And as you mentioned, the gold exports, the gold mining in Sudan, which has increased quite a bit in the last decade. This brings us to the other big player, which you mentioned, which is the United Arab Emirates, UAE, which has been the main backer of the Rapid Support Forces, the other part of the war in the country. If we could expand a bit more on that connection, because a lot of the reports have shown that a lot of the gold has been smuggled by the RSF to UAE.
And recently we've even done some reporting that the crazy part is not only is the RSF selling its gold to the UAE and the UAE kind of, extracting that gold and helping out with the whole operation, SAF is selling its gold to the UAE as well. That's one of the biggest contradictions in this war. And people, average citizens started asking the question of like, okay, so if the UAE is funding the RSF and supporting it militarily and economically, why is SAF selling its gold to the UAE as well? Are you're indirectly funding the same forces that you're fighting? So what is this war really about? It's not for the, uplifting of Sudan and stuff like the SAF says, if you're using your main economic resource to fund with UAE. And that kind of goes to the older relationship with the UAE. Not old as in, historically, but as far as kind of, in recent years, the UAE's relationship started with SAF, not with the RSF, because when the Saudis and the UAE started their war against the Houthis in Yemen, Ansar Allah, they recruited primarily all of the ground forces from Sudan. SAF was the one coordinating it in 2014, and they brought along the RSF as a fighting force over there. And this is kind of where UAE started to realize that, if they throw enough money at SAF and the RSF, then they'll have unlimited recruitment, not to mention the, kind of monopolizing the gold industry in Sudan, but also, playing a part in other industries like livestock, for example. Livestock is a huge economic export in Sudan, and it's primarily, in the RSF regions of Darfur and large areas of Kordofan and stuff like that. So they kind of cemented their grip on Sudan since that time. And this goes into, like, this is the Bashir era. So this is, Bashir historically has had a strained relationship with the Arab Gulf and was closer to Iran. But in 2014, he completely disconnected from Iran and went into the fold of the pro-Yemen coalition, both Saudi and the UAE, along with Egypt. But the UAE has been kind of the most nefarious player because of their support to the RSF. But the UAE has also kind of tried to, get the civilians on its side. It had poured heavy money into the civilian constructs, which are embodied in the political parties that were had the main upper hand within that transitional period from 2019 to 2022. So they're seeing themselves as kind of being the influencers and the main military player in not only in Sudan but in Africa as well. If you look at the UAE and its role in supporting at least in its war against the TPLF and, like, cementing Abiy Ahmed's position, them moving to recognize Somaliland and pushing for that heavily in the West, working on trying to get even more Red Sea ports and add it to their kind of arsenal of, the sea trade. So when you look at the UAE, and they even, they're pretty much controlling the Juba government right now in South Sudan. They have a really strong relationship with Ruto in Kenya, with Museveni in Uganda, with Kagame in Rwanda. So the UAE has its hands in a lot of places, not to mention Tanzania as well. So they have their hands all over the Horn and East Africa. There's nothing stopping them from supporting the RSF, supporting Idris Deby in Chad, and but that's where the buck stops. Like, once you get to the Sahel countries, like Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso, they don't play that. Like, they have clearly woken up to the nefarious, moves of the UAE by supporting militias and like the RSF and stuff. So, and like the Azawad in Mali and everything. So the UAE's influence, unfortunately, it's expanding well beyond. Egypt is more concerned with its immediate neighbors along the Nile. That's why they've also kind of pushed the Sudanese government to take a hostile stance against Ethiopia and against the GERD dam and stuff like that. But it's more contained. The UAE has a much bigger footprint in Africa. I've even talked to some of the, Kenyan journalists, and told them that, if the UAE can't get its way, it'll find a way to start some kind of civil war within the country. But it's just to give a bigger picture of how much the UAE and why the UAE feels comfortable supporting an RSF, it's because they have a foothold in a lot of the African countries, unfortunately.
And one could say also the other reason they feel uncomfortable is that they have a strong ally in the United States, letting them do that.
That's the main thing. Like that's the main aspect that gives them that, kind of audacity to move in all of these countries. It's the UAE, it's the US and Israel. Whatever happens, there will never be an active, boycotting or penalizing of the UAE from the US at all. And even European countries. The UAE knows who to buy off within each one of these European countries so that none of them actually take action against the UAE. I do believe there have been either Canada or the UK or some of these countries have put restrictions on arms sales to the UAE, but no meaningful action has been taken against them. But because they have that backing, of course, from the US and the closest ally of Israel in the region.
Listen to a recent conversation dissecting foreign involvement in the war in Sudan with Musa Baba of Ion Network, a media outlet in Sudan. The music in the background is Siku Zedu by Oliver Mtukudzi, and we play that remembering Oliver Mtukudzi's birthday, which was on September 22nd. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation. And which begs the question about the Sudan Quartet, whether it means anything when you have Egypt, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and the US trying to bring about peace in Sudan. What does that really mean? I mean, I just heard them just recently. I think they're supposed to have made some advancements in peace talks on September 12th, around the September 12th, I believe, putting together a roadmap for bringing about peace in the country. How can we take that seriously when you have the three, almost all of them, playing a double game in the country, in Sudan's the situation as it struggles with its conflict?
These are like this has been going on since the beginning of the war. Saudi Arabia kind of being the country that hosts the peace talks and bringing SAF and RSF together. The tragedy about Sudan's war is that these countries are backing different sides, but they have perfect relations with each other. The UAE invests heavily in Egypt, and it's almost like a Libya situation, but they're agreeing to kind of split the spoils among themselves, and that's kind of why they don't have credibility with either the political players or the armed groups that are in there. SAF is not going to go by any statement that comes out with the UAE on it. And at the same time, the RSF is not going to go along with any policy that's partially been carved by Egypt as well. So there's the they're not in a place to demand because they've kind of created these monsters that they can't control right now. The incentives for SAF and RSF to stop the war are pretty much nil. And if you're, the Quad, and you're putting out a statement that's making demands and that, future governments will not include SAF and RSF and everything, and it's because it's a top-down approach that probably won't go anywhere. There's already been negative response to it by Burhan, and just because also like. You have the NCP kind of moving things in Sudan. That's Bashir's Islamist party, and they of course are they know that any kind of democratic change is not in their It's not to their benefit, and it loosens their grip that they have on SAF and on what's going on in the country right now. But the alternative approach is what the African Union is doing, is basically starting a dialogue, a political consultation among all the political forces in Sudan. And of course, that gets a little bit complicated, but it's a much better approach than this kind of neocolonial way of, getting together as the Quad and then making demands, knowing that the influence of these countries has reduced significantly. The US is pretty much has a hands-off approach right now. And, even the actors know that the US is not going to get involved in any shape or form. So it doesn't like move them or phase them. It doesn't seem like it's phasing them at all. Sanctions and everything are for countries that have, proper economic setups, and they have like, connection to the international market and everything. We have a situation where these forces are, extracting their own resources and selling it to their own clients. They're kind of not really tied down by any economic sanctions, or, they're not engaging with the international market in an official way. So yeah, it would be good if these kind of things actually move towards stopping the war, or at least like having a humanitarian ceasefire or something like that. But the actors are kind of way beyond that, because they've gotten into a situation where they've caused the death of so many people, and they've kind of recruited the worst of the worst. Especially on the RSF side, for them to cede power, it's going to be a very difficult thing, knowing that there's at some point there's going to be some sort of accountability that comes in, unless there's a like a comprehensive reconciliation process. There's no international diplomatic pressure that can stop the war, unfortunately.
Again, that's Musab Baba. He is of AN Network, a media outlet in Sudan, and we're dissecting foreign involvement in Sudan's war. And as you're talking about the people recruiting other actors, other elements within the war, it just brings to mind the plane that was shot down recently in August from UAE, which had mercenaries from Colombia. And has there been more information about the number of Colombian mercenaries that have been involved within the war? And ostensibly, it looks like these mercenaries were fighting with the RSF. And of course, the UAE said that was not their plane. As usual, the UAE has refused that they're not that involved. But have you heard of anything else in terms of the mercenary situation from Colombia?
I haven't seen any, 100% credible reports, but I have seen some reports that are saying basically that the UAE is using these Colombian mercenaries through like a security company, like outsourcing. The UAE doesn't have troops to send or anything, but the and it's really something that's been puzzling me. Why, out of all places, the UAE, the Colombia specifically, and that hasn't been kind of clarified 100% yet, but. It seems like the UAE is using security companies to recruit people, especially like, more specialized military personnel. Drone operators was a big one, as far as using the drones that the UAE is supplying the RSF. The RSF probably doesn't have the cadre that can actually, operate all these drones. Because that's one of the shifts that happened within this year in the war. It went from being ground troops doing operations on the ground and hitting certain areas, and to now the heavy usage of drones. Like the drone warfare has really taken the war to a different place. You know, if you remember a few months ago, there was also, you know, when the SAF hit that plane in Niala, then the retaliation from the RSF was hitting Port Sudan and hitting, like, you know, fuel tankers and hitting the airport in Port Sudan and stuff like that. And it was kind of a signal that they can escalate this if they want to. And which begs the question of if this is, according to what we understand, this is a war of survival between both factions. So the fact that they're not hitting their capitals is kind of a question mark of, well, is this a war where it's mutually understood that they're going to control their own territories and kind of fighting over the territorial areas without eliminating the other party completely? Is it a resource issue? It's just very, you know, expensive to actually, you know, fly drones and everything. And the fact that there's a lot of talk about, for example, the UAE didn't launch the attack from the RSF areas. It attacked it from Puntland in Somalia. You know, there's a port over there, the Bosaso Airport, and there's a lot of reports that these attacks were launched from there. So this is where also, like, you know, the UAE doesn't want to use all the countries in the region. You know, it could theoretically use Addis in this war, but I believe Addis has a lot more wisdom than that, and Abe wouldn't get directly involved in the war in Sudan. But it was probably pushed by the, you know, to do so by the UAE. So it's, you know, it gets to a point where these hits are very strategic, and even like from the SAF side, it was most likely the Turkish drones that they've gotten. So we almost like we have kind of a proxy war going on in Sudan. You know, it's a hybrid, you know, proxy slash civil war going on. But you know, the plane that was hit, it, you know, it had a Kenyan pilot. It even had a South Sudanese co-pilot, and it was clearly registered. The plane was registered in the UAE. The Colombians are part of, it seems like, a bigger trend of the UAE using mercenaries, and probably, you know, they'll probably find Blackwater in there, like, you know, Eric Prince's outfit. You'll probably find like remnants of what's his name, the Russian outfit
Oh,
there
you're
as
talking
well,
about Wagner
the
Group.
Wagner Group.
Yeah.
And because the UAE is kind of a hub for this kind of activity, you know, illicit, international, cross-border, you know, private versus security, you know, kind of outfits that are there in Dubai and everything. And it's, you know, that's kind of the order of the day for them.
As you were talking about the foreign involvement, the drones coming from you said Somalia area where the self-declared Somaliland, and also there's also drones coming from the UAE sending drones from Chad as well, and these are mostly like su the supporting the RSF su surve surveillance drones to see where they can get attacked. And also arms shipments and things like that from Chad. How is Chad handling that situation on that side, which is right next to Darfur? What is Chad saying, and how are they dealing with it? Are they directly involved, or it is something which is something they can't control?
The war kind of spilled over into Chad early on. You know, there's two ways that it did. You know, first of all, the UAE was very, you know, adamant about, you know, in the beginning of the war, Bin Zayed came to N'Djamena, and he met with what's his name, Mohamed Debi, and basically put in a lot of money into N'Djamena in order for them not to take an active role in the war, but more importantly, not to crush the RSF. Because Chad, with its army, it's a little complicated because also tribal elements within the Chad government are from the same groups of the RSF, the same tribal groups as the RSF. At the same time, a huge portion of the Chad ruling class are from the Zaghawa tribe who are at war with the RSF in Sudan. So there's been a lot of internal discontent within Chad of this idea of supporting the RSF or allowing the UAE to use Chad as a hub to support the RSF. And it's caused internal problems within them. You know, talks about military coups and stuff like that have surfaced over there. I don't envy Chad at all because of the situation that they're in. You know, they have Sudan to their east, and then they have Niger to their west with all of the issues that are happening in the Sahel region. So Chad has kind of been a country that's been squeezed by these, you know, movements of the RSF and other militias in the desert, as well as the conflict in Sudan itself kind of spilling over there. And, you know, not to mention the over a million refugees from Sudan that are in eastern Chad right now in refugee camps. So Chad has been definitely involved, but they've been very careful not to swing one way or another officially within the war in Sudan. But the kind of, you know, the only, you know, sin that they have is that they've taken all this money from the UAE. So, and a big part of their government is from the RSF. So, you know, you can see how that creates a, you know, a huge contradiction within the country, you know, officially not taking a side, but, you know, also, you know, kind of silently allowing this support for the RSF.
And I wanted to expand a bit more before we go on some the resource issue, particularly because it also connects with the United States. As you mentioned, the gum arabic resource that's in Sudan. Sudan has the largest amount of gum arabic. I think it's like, what, 80% of the gum, well, the gum arabic come from Sudan, something like that. And of course, the biggest need for that is the Coca-Cola company, mm-hmm. which most people don't realize, actually. If we could expand yep. a bit more on that, and because it's a long history of that. It's not something that's just happened recently that's been ongoing, and it's a supply. And what is the situation now? And it's particularly as we talk about the role of the United States.
Right. So gum arabic has always been an odd one out in Sudan, even during the height of the Bashir regime in the 90s and like their genocide on the South Sudanese. Gum arabic was the only product that was not considered in any, was given an exception from the sanctions on the Bashir regime, right? And this kind of, you know, it opened the door for companies to come in, like especially French companies and stuff, to come in and, you know, extract that gum arabic and, you know, be the hub between the U.S. and Sudan. Little by little, there started, you know, as Sudan started to move towards kind of nationalizing the gum arabic. You know, it was nationalized back in the day already, but little by little, like working with these like French companies were used to, you know, they were extracting it, but there was a move to kind of renationalize it again. But this, of course, fell apart when you start seeing all of the, you know, instability within Sudan. It made it more lucrative for gum arabic harvesters to, you know, sell it to the highest bidder. And in this case, it was mostly smuggled out of Sudan. You know, a lot of it was smuggled to Ethiopia. A lot of it was smuggled to Chad. And funny enough, in 2023, once the war started, Kenya's export of gum arabic kind of, upticked and went to an all-time high. And that's also because of kind of like how much the RSF control of the gum arabic areas and how much they're smuggling, whether it's through Chad or through Kenya or through Ethiopia. They took advantage of that. So now it's kind of still the one constant is that the flow of gum arabic never stops. There's always buyers. Like you said, like the Coca-Cola company uses it, and I'm pretty sure a lot of other manufacturers are using gum arabic, whether it's for sodas or whether it's for other products. But that's one constant, and it's one of the exports that are mostly smuggled right now out of the country.
And do you have any closing thoughts for us as we look at the foreign involvement in Sudan's war?
Well, I think we're at a point finally where, I'm also of the opinion that the war in Sudan won't stop until the Sudanese themselves start realizing these contradictions and, stop supporting the war effort and start demanding an end to the war, as, as time goes on, as the cost, the human cost, has just been astronomical. People's entire livelihoods have gone, entire areas have been destroyed. So that will happen because of the contradictions on the international level.
You've just been listening to a portion of a recent conversation with Musab Baba of IN Network, a media outlet in Sudan. The conversation dissected and contextualized the war in Sudan, focusing particularly on external players exacerbating the war and regional dynamics and the exploitation of Sudan's resources. The full conversation will be available on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Africa by the John Coltrane Quartet. And we play that remembering John Coltrane's birthday, which was yesterday, September 23rd. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muisa Muntali. Up next is Headline News, which is followed by Sha'anana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, particularly spotlighting the plight of Palestinians. And that's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, and which is followed by The Browder File with Tony Browder, which is followed by Sojourner Truth with Nana Gayimpi, and that's followed by Kombit Lakai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nasella and Claire Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Kozer and Funan Gonda, and the Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdison. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs here on WPFW. We're going to leave with a closing song entitled Winnie Mandela, Beloved Heroine by Sathima B. Benjamin, remembering Winnie Mandela's birthday, which is on September 26th. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Israeli forces are nearing the center of Gaza City amid fears of intense street-to-street fighting. Those remaining in Gaza City, thought to be hundreds of thousands, face the constant threat of bombardment, collapsing hospitals, and dwindling food and water. A new UN inquiry has accused Israel of committing acts of genocide in Gaza and blamed senior Israeli leaders for inciting it. In a report released yesterday, the UN Commission of Inquiry on the occupied Palestinian territory says Israel is looking to establish permanent control in Gaza and establish a Jewish majority in the occupied West Bank. The commission urged Israel and all countries to fulfill their obligations under international law to end the genocide as global leaders rally to Palestine and President Trump remains unmoved. The president has changed his stance towards Ukraine. WPFW's Noah Portner has the story.
In a lengthy and emphatic post on Truth Social yesterday, President Trump appeared to reverse much of his position on Ukraine. The post called Russia a paper tiger, who was militarily weak and economically reeling. Perhaps most significantly, Trump backed the Ukrainians' ambition for total reclamation of occupied territory, something he had dismissed before. He said Ukraine was, quote, in a position to fight and win all of Ukraine back in its original form, end quote. Still, when directly asked about whether or not he distrusts Putin while seated beside Ukraine's Zelensky yesterday, President Trump said, quote, I'll let you know in about a month from now, end quote. So the president has sent mixed signals, siding with Ukraine's optimistic territorial ambitions while refusing to punish Russia through further sanctions. Tensions in Eastern Europe are high right now after Russian aircraft repeatedly flew into NATO airspace in recent days. From WPFW News, I'm Noah Portner.
In other news, the World Health Organization today refuted the Trump administration's claim that the use of acetaminophen, commonly known as Tylenol, by pregnant women may be associated with an increased risk of neurological conditions such as autism and ADHD in children. The WHO joined the international pushback against the Trump administration's warning by saying there is, quote, no conclusive scientific evidence confirming a possible link, close quote. WHO recommended that all women continue to follow advice of their doctors or health workers who can help assess individual circumstances and recommend necessary medicines. And the deadline for the government shutdown is October 1st, and with the president refusing to compromise and Democrats refusing to budge, a shutdown seems more and more likely. Here again is WPFW's Noah Portner.
With only 1 week left until the shutdown deadline, major government services are at risk of being taken offline imminently. Republicans have stressed the discretionary power the president would have in a government shutdown, deciding which employees and agencies will be affected, as well as controlling the length of the shutdown. Trump tends to be far more critical of the government than Democrats, granting him some leverage. Senator Chuck Schumer is leading the Democrats in the Senate, and he says he wants the compromise. He admitted to MSNBC's Morning Joe today that he knows he won't get everything, but stressed that President Trump is not even faking compromise after canceling a meeting with Schumer yesterday.